Podcast and Google Play Music. Only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
WPFW, Washington.
From WPFW News, I'm Sue Goodwin, news director at WPFW. With me today is reporter and producer Noah Portner. This is usually when you would be listening to We the People with David Whetstone, and he will be back. Today, we bring you some special programming on the genocide in Gaza. I'm going to start with today's news. Gaza's health ministry has recorded 10 deaths due to famine and malnutrition over the past 24 hours, including two children, bringing the total number of hunger-related deaths to 313. Israeli forces have killed 32 Palestinians since dawn today, including 8 waiting for aid. And Israeli tanks pushed more into Gaza City neighborhoods overnight, shelling homes, wounding residents, and prompting mass civilian displacement. This is the news we hear every day. More attacks, more starvation, more occupation of Palestinian land, and more genocide. And the question we have, so many of us have, is what will it take to end? During this hour, we're going to be hearing from some of the people who could no longer sit by and just ask that question. They demanded that they take action and demand action of the rest of us to stop the horror. And they are responding with incredibly planned, thought out, and powerful activism. So to start the show, I'm going to turn you over to my host, Noah Portner, who will introduce our first powerful guest.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you for introducing me and walking everybody through the show today. Joining us first is Alyssa Dowetti, an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. Alyssa, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Noah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, or Anissa, excuse me. Why don't you start off by telling us who you are and what the Palestinian Youth Movement's all about?
Yeah, so my name is Anissa. I am an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement, our DMV chapter here based in Washington, D.C. The Palestinian Youth Movement is a transnational, grassroots, and independent organization of Palestinian and Arab youth in the diaspora who are fighting for the liberation of our homeland from Zionism and settler colonialism. One of our goals is to really confront and isolate Zionism in all of its manifestations here in the diaspora. And we do that through a lot of different work within the community. We have a couple of international campaigns happening, like the Mask Off MERCE campaign that is working to end the shipping of weapons components to the Zionist entity. We have some local campaigns, and right now we are getting ready for our second annual People's Conference for Palestine that's happening in Detroit this weekend, where we want to gather people from all over our community who have been invested in the work, who have taken up work in their locales and internationally for the liberation of our homeland of Palestine and an end to the genocide in Gaza.
Those are all great things, and I want to get detailed into some of your campaigns later on, like the MERCE campaign especially. But first, why don't you help set the stage? Give us the history of the organization. When did you all come together? Was it all at once after the start of the invasion?
So PYM has been around for a while now. I think, you know, obviously in the last couple of years, we saw a moment where, you know, our movement was deeply politicized and deeply agitated around what's happening in Gaza right now, and also in the West Bank with all of the attacks on the different towns and cities and villages. And so in the last couple of years, we've been a mobilizing resource, trying to, you know, get our people together to mobilize in the streets to continue these demands, and then also to continue to organize. So not just being in the streets, but actually developing different projects and campaigns and compiling and consolidating our resources together, you know, again, to confront Zionism in all the ways that it manifests. Our people have been under occupation for years, for decades. And so we've been around for, I'd say, a while. I think that our work has just kind of grown with our movement in the last, you know, couple of years. And so this is where all of that work has kind of led to.
And you said that a lot of members were diaspora members. Is there people with ancestry from the region, from Palestine even, in represented?
Yeah, of course. So our members are Palestinian and Arab who are living in the diaspora. So some of them, you know, may have grown up back home. Some of them may have been born here who have never been able to visit back home, who are, you know, the children of refugees. Everyone kind of has their own their own history and their own paths that led them to, you know, where they are now organizing for Palestine. And some are not Palestinian. Some are, you know, as Arabs, we really consider ourselves, you know, one people. And so some people don't have family in Palestine, but are still directly impacted by what's happening and still feel that connection to our brothers and sisters in Palestine.
That's great. Why don't you tell me about, or tell us about, the movement's vision? Where would you like to see Palestinian youth movement? What do you want the role to be in the future?
Yeah. Our fight is for the right to return for all of our people, for all of the refugees that have been forcefully displaced from their homelands, and a full and total liberation of the land from the Zionist occupation and from any occupation. So all of our work is geared towards that. And when we look at what's happening in Gaza, we see Gaza as our moral and political compass in that goal. Our vision, we want our people in Gaza to know that they are not alone, that the masses stand with them. Over the last 2 years now, you know, we've been able to be a resource for our people to really, like, take up a lot of work in the diaspora and channel a lot of that anger and frustration and hopelessness into, you know, into our movement and channel that into, you know, a feeling of determination, of commitment, of revolutionary optimism for these goals. And so we have a responsibility to continue to build this movement and to realize where our strengths lie. And our strength lies in the masses. Our strength lies with the people who are standing by the people in Palestine, who are not going to allow this genocide to continue without holding those war criminals accountable, who are not only doing mobilizations, but are also doing workshops and education, and who are building art. You know, the song that you all played in the beginning of this segment was people in Gaza who are harmonizing and singing along to the sound of the drone strikes, and this is or sound of the drones that are in the background. And this is just one small example of how our people in Gaza have stayed resilient and have shown us that, you know, even though they are facing the worst conditions imaginable, they are still remaining resilient. They're still remaining steadfast, and they still believe in, you know, their right to hold on to their homeland and to live on their land, and for the people to be able to return who've been displaced.
I see. Well, one aspect of your movement, which is a bit different from others, is that you're a youth movement and you want a youthful perspective to inform your strategies and your ideology. How do you think that has affected how the movement has gone?
Yeah, historically, youth have always played a leading role in our struggle. Our struggle is our responsibility. It's ours to carry forward. We've always kind of been a uniting force for people of all different movements. And youth are often the spark in the revolution. We may not have created this revolution. We may not have, you know, built the foundation of it, but we learn from previous generations and we build on top of their experiences. We build alongside with them. You know, there are a lot of people who are young at heart, who still are organizing and who still are out in the streets with us. And so we know the importance of like keeping all of us united through all of these generations and to push these generations forward. There's a famous quote from one of the previous prime ministers of the Zionist entity that says, the old will die and the young will forget. And so our role is to make sure that our youth do not forget about their people, about their history, about their responsibility in the struggle, that we understand and we honor what our parents and our grandparents' generations, you know, have sacrificed and what their role was, their active role in the liberation struggle for almost 80 years now. And so us being here in the diaspora positions us to fight on a different front line, right? We're still confronting Zionism and imperialism from the belly of the beast, from one of the largest entities, and especially here in Washington, D.C., where we are, you know, in the heart of this empire. We know that we're in a special position to be able to confront all of these systems that are oppressing our people back home. And especially now, you know, to unite in the face of Trump's oppression is an even larger and even more important task. Palestine has always been a testing ground for imperialists, right? For their weapons, for how they set up their checkpoints, for the prison systems, even how they use propaganda as a tool and a weapon to shape, you know, society perception and all of those things that we're seeing now manifest in the U.S., in the States. All of those things have been a reality and have been something that our people in Palestine have confronted on a daily basis. And so being that uniting force and being that spark for the people to be able to stay united, to be able to be disciplined in how we carry ourselves forward through this movement is always so important. And so that is how we see the role of the youth in our movement.
That's great. There are tons of youth in Gaza right now living in some pretty horrible conditions. How hard is it to coordinate with the youth living there right now? Is it impossible, or do you know many people there?
I think we definitely take you know, kind of our lead from our people who are on the ground. And we echo their calls as much as we can. We honor our martyrs as often and as loudly. And, you know, through all of our work, we carry them with us. I think, again, in terms of like coordination, I think our role here, we're positioned a little bit differently. And so it's, we can't fight the fight that's on the ground that's happening right now, but we can fight for this against the systems that are allowing this to happen. We can, you know, hold the war criminals that are literally our neighbors here in Washington, D.C. accountable for the things that they are doing to our families and our loved ones back home. And so that for us, that's how we're able to kind of stay connected with them. There are a lot of people who are in our community and in our organization who do have family back home, who do find it very difficult to stay in contact with them, to get updates from them. You know, and there's a very intentional effort to silence not only the movement and not only organizers, but also journalists, right? We know how the journalists in Gaza have been deliberately targeted and assassinated. And so for us, those are the people who are telling the story. Those are the people who are giving us the firsthand accounts of what is going on for us to be able to inform our work here. The thing, these are not separate things, but we have to be able to like inform each other. And so without their stories, without their cameras, without their microphones, you know, this has been a live stream genocide for the last 2 years, that we've all been a witness to, and something that we full heartedly believe is that one of our main roles is to be a witness, is to bear witness to what's happening. As devastating as it is, as heartbreaking as it is our duty and responsibility to bear witness so that we can, you know, we know who we're up against. We know what, you know, how all of these things manifest, and we understand what our people are actually going through as deeply as we can. And we use that to inform a lot of our work and to be able to build and maintain a fighting movement for the right of return and for a liberated Palestine.
That's fantastic. I know you guys have another main strategy too, which is to disrupt the supply line, which brings deadly weapons into Palestine. Can you tell everyone a little bit more about the Maersk campaign that you guys went on?
Yes. So we have an international campaign. It's called Mask Off Maersk. And so for those who don't know, Maersk is an international logistics and shipping company that is directly complicit in the genocide and in the ongoing occupation in Palestine. Maersk was, through extensive research, we found that Maersk was responsible for shipping these weapons components to the Zionist entity, to a lot of the settler colonies that are in on occupied Palestinian land. And so through that research, we've been able to help develop this campaign and a lot of different tactics to be able to disrupt that supply chain. And so it's important to know that this is not just a PYM initiative or a PYM campaign. This is the people's campaign. The people's are calling for this arms embargo, are demanding an arms embargo, and are actually like implementing it, you know, with their own work, with their own hands, with their own bodies. We've seen developments in Morocco, how the people in Morocco have taken this on, understanding that the government in Morocco is a normalizing government. And so allowing the Maersk ships to dock there on their way to Israel, the people have been able to mobilize, and the workers have said that they will not be complicit and they will not help and aid in, you know, this transfer of the weapons materials that are being sent there. We've seen developments similar to that in Spain, where Spain had the arms embargo when we first started this campaign. And there's been a lot of different developments internationally that have tied into this campaign, and a lot of places have taken this up locally, where we know a lot of these weapons are being shipped from the U.S., right, with all of the weapons manufacturers that are here. And understanding that there's no pleading to the morality of a weapons manufacturer. You know, they know exactly what they're creating. They know what it's going to be used for. So there's no asking a weapons manufacturer, hey, can you stop making weapons? It's, we're not going to allow you to actually send them to do what you think this is going to do. We're not going to allow, you know, the weapons to be delivered or all of these different parts to be assembled and then shipped off to murder our people. And so this has been a mass campaign for, you know, people all across the globe. We've seen Greta Thunberg take up action against Maersk at their headquarters. So again, this is not just PYM's initiative or campaign. This is the people's campaign for an arms embargo.
Just to clarify, you're not calling for a general boycott. It's specifically to stop shipping weapons on these ships, correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm. So we are, we are pushing for kind of all aspects of the overall BDS campaign. But it is a more like physical action of stopping that flow of weapons. Hmm.
Another campaign I see here is against Virginia Retirement Services. I'm from Virginia, so this is very interesting to me. It's a divestment campaign, but I don't know much else about it. So why don't you tell us?
Right. So the VRS is the Virginia Retirement System. And so many public employees are a part of the system, you know, as they want to be able to, as they work, they want to be able to know that their futures are secure, and they want to be able to know that, you know, that they're working for meaningful lives in the future for when they retire. And so again, through the research that we've done, through the Mask Off Maersk campaign, and just to understand our locale more deeply, we recognize and we found that the VRS has been or is invested in several weapons manufacturing companies like Lockheed Martin, like Boeing, like Raytheon and Maersk. So not only one company, there are several companies on this list that are, you know, profiting off of the genocide in Gaza, the occupation of Palestine, and are generally invested in the U.S.'s war machine across the globe, right? This isn't something that is only affecting Palestine. This is affecting many oppressed peoples and communities across the globe. And so the VRS actually is invests hundreds of millions of dollars in weapons manufacturers and logistics companies. And we know that, you know, millions of pounds of U.S. military cargo gets shipped to Israel every year. And so the VRS campaign is a campaign to mobilize and to organize the workers of Virginia. They should be allowed to say where their money goes. They should be allowed to, you know, retire in peace, knowing that, you know, they're working for the state of Virginia and they're working in public schools and in all these different sectors, did not contribute to a war, did not continue to contribute to a genocide. And so that's what the VRS campaign is generally. And so we just launched this campaign. It's fairly new. And so if you go on Instagram, it's the VRS Divest page, and you'll be able to stay connected. There's a petition to sign. And so our demands are to divest any direct holdings in weapons manufacturers and shipping companies that facilitate the genocide of the Palestinian people. And the second demand is to revise the VRS investment policy to ensure that it does not invest in any companies that manufacture or ship weapons components.
Is this campaign mostly public outreach, or are you going to try to reach the people who are invested in VRS, these civil servants you talked about?
There's going to be a lot of different components to this campaign. And like I said, it's still fairly new. So there's going to be a lot of different ways for both organizers and, you know, public employees to be able to participate in whatever their capacity is. The hope is that this will be similar to the Mask Off Maersk campaign, where it is the people's campaign. This is going to be the people's campaign of Virginia to be able to take up and hold the VRS accountable.
Now, there are a lot of other youth movements in the diaspora supporting Gaza right now all across the world. Are you in contact with any of these other movements? Yes.
Yeah, of course. So again, the fight for Palestinian liberation and our struggle is a struggle that speaks to so many different organizations, so many different oppressed peoples across the globe. And so, like I said, like even this campaign that we're talking about, the VRS campaign, this is not something that only impacts Palestinians. This is something that impacts all oppressed people who might be living under occupation, who, you know, are suffering at the hands of U.S. and Israeli imperialism across the globe. And so we do work very closely with a lot of our you know, solidarity partners, and we work in joint struggle with them often. And, you know, throughout the last 2 years, there's been so much support coming from a lot of different communities and a lot of different movements, because they understand that our struggle and our liberation and our futures are interconnected. A lot of the things that, again, here in Washington, D.C., when we talk about the federal takeover, and we talk about this occupation, and we talk about how immigrants are being, you know, directly targeted by ICE, and we're talking about Black youth who are being targeted by so many different agencies, and we talk about the prison systems, a lot of that, again, like Palestine has been a testing ground for that for so long, to see how these prison systems can disappear people and can manipulate people and can, you know, play into the psychological warfare. And it's intended to break our unity. It's intended to break our spirits. It's intended to break the community power that has been built up over, you know, decades of work within each of our communities and the work that we've done together. And so that's, you know, that's not an exception here. We understand that we can't be successful unless we are united. And so with different immigrant communities, with Black liberation struggles, with the struggle for, you know, Puerto Rican independence, with the struggle for, you know, U.S. militarization out of the Philippines, like we work with so many different people and so many different communities to be in joint struggle with them and to see all of our people liberated.
Well, you're based in D.C., and the U.S. is obviously a huge contributor to the war, to the arms that are shipped to Israel. Do you do any direct outreach to politicians, reach out to representatives, federal government, or you try to keep it all grassroots and mostly facing the community?
Our goal is we are a grassroots organization. We aim to mobilize and organize our communities. And our communities are always empowered to take up the work of confronting elected officials. And there's a lot of different efforts that we may not lead, but we definitely support, that, you know, go and talk to politicians or demand that they are and their complicity in the genocide and their support for the, you know, the financial, like the financial support and the military support for Israel. There's also been efforts to call them out directly. And there's been a lot of organizing around, you know, going to, you know, different people's offices and sometimes even their homes. Like people have kind of taken that up. To say that you can't have a moment of peace if you're going to support this genocide, because our people do not have a moment of peace. So there's a lot of different ways that the work has manifested. And, you know, some of it we take on, we take the lead on. Some of it we work very closely with our solidarity partners. And some of it we support our solidarity partners who have taken the lead on a lot of that work as well. So there's so many different ways that this movement has manifested. And even here in D.C., there's no shortage of work. And I think we're all very supportive of each other and how we're able to kind of split that work up and confront all of these war criminals and confront Zionism in all of its different areas and manifestations.
Well, for my last question, I want to look towards the future and ask, what does the Palestinian youth movement see as the future for Gaza, as the future for this movement?
For Gaza, we see a liberated land. Again, Gaza is our moral and political compass and is guiding so many of us towards true liberation. So we are witnessing what's happening right now. We're witnessing the attacks, the assassinations. We're witnessing the bombardment that's happening, but we're also witnessing their resilience. We're witnessing their steadfastness. And we know that their sacrifices will not be in vain. We know that This is all leading up to a liberated Palestine, to people being able to return to their homelands, to be able to cultivate their culture, to be able to hold on to these traditions. All of this is working towards the liberation of our homeland. And again, we're getting ready for our second annual People's Conference for Palestine up in Detroit this weekend. And so this is going to be a space for all of us to be able to convene, to talk about our different experiences in this movement, to talk about, you know, we'll hear from people who are on the ground, who are seeing this, you know, firsthand. We have a lot of different speakers that are coming, you know, from people who have participated in different freedom flotillas, to Mahmoud Khalil, who was targeted by the Trump administration and by ICE. There's going to be so many different, you know, sessions and workshops, all in an effort to continue to build our power, to consolidate all of our knowledge and all of our experiences, and to fight against not only Trump's ongoing oppression here in the States, but also the oppression that our people are facing against Zionism and imperialism. And so I'm very excited for this weekend. I'm very excited to bring back all of the experience and the knowledge and the conversations that are had there back here to DC. We're gonna see a lot of people internationally coming in for this conference who are also gonna be able to take this back to their areas as well. And so I see our movement continuously growing in numbers, in power, and I do see a liberated Palestine in the future, from the river to the sea.
If people are very interested in this upcoming event in Detroit, can they tune in online, or it's more of a brainstorm that you'll then bring back to DC?
All of the above. Last year, and I am hoping for this year as well, all of last year's sessions are still available online on YouTube. And so some of them were live streamed, some of them were uploaded. And so I'm hoping that the same will happen this year again. And then from all different locales across the U.S., there's going to be different workshops and conversations of lessons learned to bring back to our communities and our locales, to be able to apply a lot of those lessons to fighting, you know, the oppression and Zionism that's manifesting in all of our different areas. So there'll be a lot of different resources that people can tune into afterwards. And people are still, it's not too late to join and to register for the conference now. So if people want to hop on a plane or a bus to come to Detroit, you're more than welcome. And I hope to see you there.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us, Anissa. This was a great conversation. I learned so much.
Thank you so much, Noah. I appreciate you all and for the invitation to speak about our work, and also for how you all use your platform to uplift Palestinian voices and voices of all oppressed people across the world.
Yes, that's always a goal at WPFW. Thank you, Anissa.
Thank you.
This is Rev Yearwood, the host of Climate Friday. On Friday, August 29th, 9 a.m. until 7 p.m., we present From the Ninth Ward to the Airwaves, commemorating the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Produced by the Hip Hop Caucus in partnership with WPFW, our programming will highlight the community organizing being done in its wake, unpack the ongoing impact of the storm, center the voices of those who lived through it, and offer reflections on the lives lost. That's From the Ninth Ward to the Airwaves, commemorating the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
As you prepare your breakfast, think of others. Do not forget to feed the pigeons. As you wage your wars, think of others. Do not forget those who fight for peace. As you pay your water bill, think of others, those who are nursed by clouds. As you return home to your home, think of others. Do not forget the people of the camps. As you sleep and count the stars, think of others, those who have nowhere to sleep. As you liberate yourself with metaphors, think of others, those who have lost their right to speak. As you think of others far away, think of yourself and say, if only I were a candle in the night.
This is for Palestine, of course, the capital, Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the war when they're shooting them. Suppression is a question,
Resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza, Palestine or Quds, the capital Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall and they're shooting them. Suppression is a question. Resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
All you see is war every time you turn your head at night. Bloodshed on the floor. Mother cries, who cries for her this time? Truth between these walls. See the lies between the lines they hide. Where the bullets coming from? From the tyrants dressed in our disguise.
I'ma ride until the end. Even if I got a pushback for all my friends. Cause you know that I'm a fighter. Let me see a lighter. And we not gonna stop the Palestine is free. But still you know that I'ma ride until the end. Even if I got a pushback for all my friends. Cause you know that I'm a fighter. Let me see a lighter. And we not gonna stop the Palestine is free.
Taught to not know, taught to be blind, taught to not care. Tell me what's real, borderline military despair. How to exist if there's no rights to be human in fear. And if you take away your home, where's the house supposed to live? Taught to not know, taught to be blind, taught to not care. Tell me what's real, borderline military despair. How to exist if there's no rights to be human in fear. And if you take away your home, where's the house supposed to live?
Ibrahim Abu Thureya could resist without a wheelchair. 10-year challenge, tell Rick if we are still here. And tell that killer Netanyahu he should feel fear. The old live through us and guarantee the children will care. Criminal, not invincible and you know it. Sarmadun still sitting in their stoic. May not feel us with you when you listen to our poems. You inspire humanity, your resistance is heroic. Regardless of talk, here's time we answer the call. Through your strength of spirit, you provide example for all. How to live, how to love when attacked from the clouds above. Loud and clear, the songs you sung can't be drowned by the sound of guns. Won't just watch your tragic times through a satellite dish. The least that we can give you is an anthem like this. They panic tried.
And we're back. Today, we are doing a special on Gaza with the people who are fighting back, who are bringing their voice, their experience to this issue to stop the genocide, to stop the horror that's taking place. And one of the issues that's getting some attention, needs some more, is media complicity. How the media itself here in the United States, around the world, is part of allowing this to happen. And joining us now is a woman who is fighting that fight. Her name is Hazami Barmada, and she's an organizer with the Gaza Media Encampment. Media Accountability Encampment. I'm going to let her tell us what that is. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So, first of all, tell us what exactly is a Media Accountability Encampment and what's happening on North Capitol Street here in Washington, D.C.?
So, in essence, an encampment, the vision of encampment started during Vietnam era. We've had also during the AIDS epidemic where there were die-ins and sit-ins. And so this is a form of protest where it's built on endurance and perseverance and just kind of consistency of messaging. And the reason we set up a media encampment was the need for media to be highlighted as a central player and a central problem in Israel's atrocities and enabling Israel's atrocities right here in the United States and manufacturing consent for war crimes, for crimes against humanity, for barbaric policies, including forced starvation of civilians. And the media continues to not only whitewash Israel's crimes, but make excuses for it, make it sound better and more palpable to the American public, and in some cases, outright lying about what Israel is doing. And so in being there in front of NBC, MSNBC, CNBC, Fox, Sky News, ITN, and multiple other media outlets that are housed in that building, we are able to constantly remind the staff and their executives that we are watching them and that history will continue to judge media for the role that it played in enabling atrocities. But more importantly, it's not too late. It's not too late to change tune. Yes, we are 23 months into a genocide with countless lives lost, with Gaza annihilated, but it is still not too late to highlight the atrocities that Israel is committing and to expose the American people to the life of Palestinians living under apartheid occupation and brutality of Israel.
Hazami, I want to ask you, the group has a set of demands, five demands, and the first two involved, they said, tell the truth clearly, report the whole truth. How does the truth not get told? You've mentioned lying, but there are other ways that you have identified that the truth about Gaza gets obstructed. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so what we mean by that when we say the truth about Gaza gets obstructed is, for example, the context is completely omitted, where to most Americans, history of what is happening in Gaza started on the 7th of October, and it's framed that way by the media. We always ask people what happened on the 5th of October, the 4th of October, the 3rd of October, the context that Gaza has been what some people call an open air prison. I don't like the term open air prison, but it helps people understand that this is a constricted, really small area of land where all access into and out of fishing off of the sea, access to the beach is all completely controlled by Israel. There's calorie restrictions. And Israel has boasted, for example, about the calorie restrictions to ensure that Palestinians are never strong enough to fight back against their occupation by Israel. These are all things that are not reported consistently in the media. The fact that baby formula and instant coffee and diapers are on the list of things that are blocked from entry into Gaza even before the 7th of October. People in Gaza have been living in inhumane conditions at the hands of their occupier, Israel. The media doesn't call Israel an occupier. It does not call the settlers as illegal squatters, which they are, even according to international law. These words aren't used. The media doesn't use the word genocide to describe what is happening, despite the fact that every single major organization in the world, including American human rights organizations and Israeli human rights organizations, reporting on this and have issued, 100 pages of reports. Of note, the Israeli press, English press, the Haaretz, which is a largely distributed Israeli press, actually speaks more boldly about Israel's atrocities than Western media and U.S. media specifically. And so that is some of the context that we're talking to when we talk about omission of fact, when we talk about a skewed perspective, where we constantly, just yesterday, or sorry, on the 25th of August, we saw a double tap attack. And what that means is that, a target is bombed, and then right when rescue workers and media goes to cover the bombing, then they are attacked. And so it was a deliberate attack on five journalists, including journalists that worked for NBC, Reuters, AP, and Al Jazeera. And you're seeing that Israel, after it realized that there was a mass global outrage, rightfully so, about the fact that they barbarically attacked a hospital compound and then followed up with a further attack on aid workers and journalists, they started to now come out and say, for example, that it was a, quote, Hamas camera. I don't even know what a Hamas camera is. I didn't know that inanimate objects could also be Hamas. But the media started using that. And you saw the Reuters and Associated Press, in the last 2 days have said, Israel's target was a, quote, Hamas camera. And it's embarrassing. And that is why we are in front of these outlets. That is why we will continue to demand accountability, because the demands that we have of the media is not going out of your way to manipulate so badly that your own headlines sound comical, which is precisely what we've seen, unfortunately, for the last 23 months coming out of Western media.
Do you have a sense of what's actually happening within these media organizations, within the editorial rooms, that would make them reluctant to use the kind of honest, true language you're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. We have done quite a bit of research. Just look at an NBC. And I want to just make note of the fact that in the last 2 weeks, we've actually seen a shift in the language of NBC, specifically as it relates to Gaza. It's not where we want it to be, but it is, you know, bounds better than where it was, which is not saying much because it was so pathetic before. But we are speaking to staff on the sidewalks outside. We are hearing from executives. We are seeing people resign from inside these newsrooms. But for example, you know, in the sidewalk right in front of NBC, we had a few reporters come and tell us that there is a lot of frustration among staff because they are told not to use certain language. They write articles, they write scripts, and they are told to redact certain information, to remove language that can be seen as, quote, harmful to Israel's image. And again, beckons the question, what is the role of media? Because historically, media was established to hold power to account, not to coddle it and to manufacture consent for its crimes. And when you have reporters and people who are on the back end of the media machines tell us things like, we were told not to harm Israel's image, then you have officially become a PR agent and you are simply engaging in entertainment and not news and journalism. And that is what we're trying to highlight to the American people, is that they have been consuming biased coverage that is pushed by oftentimes the donors and the people with influence inside these organizations, executives. And just looking at NBC, for example, look at the ranks of some of their staff, where you have, you know, more than five people in executive positions at NBC have worked for the Israeli occupation forces in PR type positions. Their job was to literally manufacture stories to present the world a more rehabilitated image of Israel's brutal army and occupation. That should be alarming to people, that somebody who is an executive producer, somebody who's a reporter, somebody who's got power to control scripts and editorial coming out of NBC, had a job prior of actually creating propaganda material for the Israeli government and its violence. And so those are the things that we're hearing from reporters, that they're feeling frustrated, they're feeling restricted. And more of that is being exposed by courageous journalists that are speaking out. We saw just a couple of days ago, a Reuters journalist resigned and spoke out, broke her silence about the restrictions that Reuters put on her when it came to the reporting and the bias that they're trying to put out on, what's happening in Gaza and Palestine.
Yes, I do feel like I'm seeing not too many, but more of these kinds of stories, such as the Reuters photojournalist that just resigned. And I want to talk about a different angle of that with you. I've been in this field for a long time, and it's drummed into our heads. Be objective, be objective, be objective. And that's our job, and we're a failure if we're not objective. Objective, of course, is a problematic word. How does this become a problem when you're talking about covering Gaza?
You're absolutely right, because what does objective mean? Because, you know, there's no equivalence between the brutality of a nuclear-backed and a nuclear state that is receiving billions upon billions of dollars in weapons and aid, direct aid through not only just weapons, but intelligence, through technology, you know, partnerships with Microsoft, partnerships with Palantir. You know, when you start to understand that you have a besieged population that is being presented as some type of an equivalent to a brutal occupying force that has, you know, for decades ruled with an iron fist, and it's part of the Zionist agenda, what is objectivity in that context? And I think, you know, it's fascinating. The American public is always very fascinating when it comes to, movies. They side with the underdog. I mean, you saw The Hunger Games. You see, you know, all of these dramas on TV where people root for the underdog. And somehow, through Israel's Hasbara campaign, which is a very curated and intentional campaign to try to influence public perception about Israel, which they pump millions of dollars into. Last year alone, they increased their budget by $150 million to counter negative images of Israel that are being put out into the world. by their own admission. I mean, they're the ones publishing videos of themselves committing crimes oftentimes. And then they're trying to figure out ways to beautify that. So objectivity in that case is, you know, I don't know. I mean, it beckons the question of who has the power to control the story? Who has the power to decide what is considered objective? And I think what I would, want people to do is to simply show what's happening without the excuses that are attached to it. For example, we have a great example in the hospital bombing that happened just a couple of days ago, because that was a prime example of how the media swooped in to try to rehabilitate Israel's image. There was a blatant attack on a hospital infrastructure. And, you know, Israel has repeatedly said, we do not attack hospitals. We do not attack hospital infrastructures. We obviously know that's a lie because dozens and dozens of hospitals have been destroyed. But this time around, they came out and they said, we're waiting for Israel to give us proof of what they were targeting. Now, no proof was presented to any media outlet from anything that I was able to find, other than Israel issuing a statement saying that the camera was Hamas. Literally, that was actually their statement. It was a Hamas camera, which most people are still trying to decipher. But the media, without interrogating that, without questioning the source, you know, they have no problem saying Gaza run health ministry before they put out any statistics, right, with the goal of obviously creating doubt in the stat. You don't see the Likud-backed, you know, Israeli government does X, Y, and Z, and the Likud party is extremist and are outright calling for the annihilation and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians without even hiding it. That is not objective.
I'm going to move you on a little bit here because we don't have a huge amount of time. So I really want to hear more about the encampment. I want to hear what would I see if I go there, when I go there, and what other activities are you all involved in? Obviously, you're doing a lot of content analysis, and it's very impressive. But tell us a little more about the encampment, what you're doing, what actions you hope to engage in the future.
So the encampment was set up on the 28th of July on the 400 Capitol block, Capitol Hill. And the reason we picked those stations is that those stations are considered, quote, neutral. And that is precisely why we went after them and not, for example, more fringe media that may not be seen as mainstream or neutral. Because if mainstream, what is presenting itself as objective is not objective, then that becomes a very big hindrance to progress because people are taking it for face value as the truth. So what you would see is we have huge banners that occupy the entire front of the building. And just a fun fact, if you actually Google 400 North Capitol Street, Google Maps from the street view actually has all of our encampment banners as part of the Google images, because the Google car must have come by when our encampment was set up. So that's a huge win. But you'll see massive branding talking about Israel attacking journalists. You'll see big, huge banners about U.S. complicity and genocide, specifically through the media. And then what we also do is we disrupt the live broadcasts with chanting and with megaphones. We are able to penetrate through the glass of the studios. And so NBC, Meet the Press, and several other shows on MSNBC, NBC, CNBC, and Fox News have repeatedly been disrupted. And people are going to social media to ask about the background noise. What are the sirens? What is that chanting? That gives us an opportunity to raise awareness about what's happening. And it has given us an opportunity to then speak to people in the newsrooms that are complaining about the sound. And when we tell them, sure, we're happy to disappear, here's our requirements. And so it has given us, a conversation piece and a point of leverage with the staff. So that is primarily what we do from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And as of last week, we have actually shifted our format a little bit. What we're doing now is what we call pop-up disruptions, so that we're not as predictable, because the NBC has completely vacated the first floor studios and are using different studios. We have leaked information from staff within NBC and various media outlets that actually helps us identify where their new recording studios are. And so we're doing pop-ups so that they can't preemptively predict where we will be. And so we went to CNN a couple of days ago with a pop-up. We will be at AP and Reuters this week with a pop-up, and then we will be back at NBC numerous times through this week, but at a more unpredictable schedule than 10 to 10, so that we could actually have more ability to disrupt live shows.
This is incredible, impressive activism. Thank you so much for doing this. I want to ask you about one of your other demands, and we don't have a lot of time. And it may seem obvious. One of your demands is amplify Palestinian voices. But I want you to tell me why that's so important, and what do we hear when we amplify those voices?
Amplifying Palestinian voices should be central to any newsroom. I mean, when you look at the statistics of some of the outlets that I mentioned, you sometimes have 5-to-1 coverage where Israeli spokespeople speak on behalf of what's happening. You have, white American talking heads that are oftentimes U.S. mercenaries speaking on behalf of starvation in Gaza. When you actually start to listen to the stories of Gaza, you will hear stories not only of the suffering, but also the resilience and the resisting spirit of Palestinians that want equity. They want equality. They want dignity. They don't want rations of food or humanitarian aid. They want to grow their own food. You will hear that, for example, Palestinian farmlands are attacked by Israel. You will hear that agriculture is destroyed by Israel. There is a direct attempt to actually destroy the very fabric of life of Palestinians. That is what you will hear if you amplify Palestinian voices on the ground inside Gaza. And here in the West, if you were to amplify stories of activism, you will hear human rights practitioners that care about everybody. Not what you're seeing now is this villainization of advocates just like myself who are smeared, who are called Jew-hating. If you were to actually listen to our stories, you will see that about 80% of our group of activists are Jewish and do not believe in a Zionist agenda. And so I think the narrative will shift drastically, and we encourage more people to amplify those voices and to listen, to make space to listen.
And one more time, let me ask you again, tell our listeners how they can be in touch with you, how they can learn more about what you're doing, and how they themselves can question their own consumption of media around Gaza.
There are multiple outlets, multiple avenues that are now questioning social media and actually helping you see for yourself how bias manifests. You can follow me on Instagram. That's primarily where we post our activism and our actions, because we are a grassroots Palestinian women-led network, and we want to remain autonomous because it gives us so much power and diversity. So my Instagram is just my name, which is H-A-Z-A-M-I, Hazami. And we will continue to share ways to get involved. And the biggest question I have, or the biggest suggestion I have for anybody questioning their bias, is flip the script. If you hear, for example, Israel has the right to defend itself, flip the script. Did Nazi Germany have the right to defend itself? Do Palestinians have the right to defend themselves? Put other scenarios in there. Does Russia have the right to defend itself? And you'll start to see how these narratives not only make no sense, but are racist and are toxic. And we cannot allow Israel to continue to get away with these slogans that, when applied to any other ethnic group, any other cultural group, any other country, would make you cringe. That is what I'm asking people to do. When you read something, any other group, any other group, again, this, white people have the right to, white people have the right to defend themselves.
Hazami, unfortunately, you're breaking up a bit. I know you're in a unique situation making connection to us, and we so appreciate you were willing to give us this time. So I'm going to let you go now. That was Hazami Barmada with the Gaza Media Accountability Encampment. Thank you so much for joining us. Your work truly is impressive.
Thank you so much. God bless.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening to this show. I hope you were inspired by these very powerful women who really are doing remarkable work. And keep listening to WPFW, of course, as we continue to cover this war, this genocide, this occupation. We will tell the truth. We will bring that to you. Noah, do you want to say goodbye and we'll close out for this hour?
Sure thing. I agree with everything you said, Sue. They are both very impressive women, and they both spoke to this idea of shared solidarity, both within the diaspora and among anyone who cares. I was inspired by that. They work with other movements. They work with people on the ground. They're really doing quite a bit.
Okay. Thank you and goodbye.
Khan Dance Company celebrates its 42nd annual National African Dance and Drum Conference, Coming Together as One, on Labor Day weekend from Friday, August 29th to Sunday, August 31st. The conference workshops will take place at the Washington Marriott Capitol Hill and will be taught by 20-plus master dancers and drummers from Senegal, Mali, Guinea, Liberia, and the Republic of Congo. This year's concert performance will take place on August 31st at 8